that you experience and when you get triggered. So I assume you were traumatized by it as adults. But if a child gets traumatized, the effects are far more damaging. Any idea why?
Well, first of all, they don't have really the verbal skills to really...
You're right on fire, all right? They lack the verbal and cognitive skills that they're not developed to be able to process their experience. So it derails, especially in sexual abuse, it can derail their psychosexual development. In a much greater way than an adult. So that's how trauma causes post-traumatic stress disorder. And specifically, we're talking about sexual abuse within the gamut of trauma, especially with children. Do you think it's on the low end of the trauma scale or the high end? It is very high. Why? What is it about sexual abuse that in particular traumatizes children to such a degree that it does? The secret, there's a lot of, you said shame.
It's threats. They threaten them.
I'm sorry?
They threaten the children.
They can often threaten the children. But what is it about sexual abuse in particular? So a child is not prepared for sexuality. They're just not prepared. They're not prepared emotionally. They're not prepared physically. They're not prepared psychologically. They're not prepared spiritually. They're not prepared relationship-wise. They are not prepared to be exposed to sexuality. And that's why we even say exposing children to pornography is sex abuse. Because those images are in their nervous system, trust me. Many of the patients I work with who were traumatized were not traumatized physically by sexual abuse, it was by ridiculously irresponsible parents who left around pornography for children to be exposed to. And those images are in their nervous system forever until they get treated, which we'll talk about in a minute. So what we've been talking about so far is what's called primary abuse. That's the actual incident that triggers the abuse. It could be unwanted touching. As we said, exposure to pornography. It could be actual sexual activity. And it happens within families, within the immediate family, extended family, camp counselors, babysitters, rabbis, teachers, neighbors, and least frequently, strangers. Most people think it's strangers. No. Most of the time, depending on the research study, it's somewhere 80 to 90%, it's someone the child knows, which just compounds the trauma because, you know, Uncle Shmuley, my uncle. I love him. He loves me. Why did he do this to me? You can imagine what that does to a child. That's primary trauma. Secondary trauma is when a child goes to the person that they trust the most to tell them what happened, to get help, to get support, to figure this out, and they look at them and they do something like saying, "That didn't happen. Don't ever say that to anybody else again. Do you know what will happen with your sister stood up and skipped out?" You're laughing. That is not funny. Maisa Shahaya, it happens. And it does not happen infrequently. What message do you tell a child when you say to him, "Shut up, don't say that"? You don't care, and they don't matter. And for a developing child, what does that do to their sense of self? What does that do to their sense of trust?
They can't trust anybody.
They don't trust anybody. And they don't trust their parents, and they don't trust the religion that the parents represent. And that's why many of these kids go up in there. And the research shows, and my own clinical experience shows it very consistently, secondary trauma is always more traumatizing than the primary trauma. Can you see why? Okay, if Uncle Shmuley does something to me, okay, so what, he's something's wrong with him. But if my parents tell me that I need to shut up, that's far more traumatizing. Far more debilitating. I want to share with you a story that represents what I'm talking about. And this just happened 2 weeks ago. You know, I've been doing this for 30 years, and you think, you know, you have the kishkas to deal with this and go home and not be affected. This one really affected. The truth is, a lot of the stories that Mayor tells me affects me. This one's a bad one. Gentleman, 39, 38 years old, and he comes to me. Anybody here knows anything about Florida, about Miami? Do you know what South Beach is? You know what the connotation of South Beach is? Okay. He was in South Beach. And as I tell the story, you'll figure it out. You'll figure it out, don't worry. Be patient. So, she's not patient. South Beach is known to have an active gay community. And this young man came to me. He was referred to me by his sister, who is Orthodox, who lives in the Northeast. And as the story goes, when he was young, approximately 5 to 6 years old, he was the oldest, the only son. All two sisters were dead. And he was with a babysitter. And she was sitting on the couch and he was playing a game. And he looked up at the couch and the babysitter had exposed herself. Totally open. And was stimulating herself. He still, the day that he came to my office, 34 years later, still was able to describe the image and still felt all of those feelings, shock, shame, confusion, revulsion, had no clue how to process as a five-year-old. Fast forward, he's struggling with this, he's struggling with the confusion. This young man did not tell his parents. And it happened a few more times until, mercifully, the babysitter was replaced. He went on and got married. I won't fill in the details, but you can figure it out yourself. They were divorced 6 months later. And what happened was that, this is his wife, he felt compelled to tell her what happened. The first time he told anybody. She told her parents. And her parents encouraged / forced her to divorce him and chose to tell everyone that they know what had happened. Why? To make sure that everybody knew it wasn't her fault so she could remarry. These things happen. It's a crazy world out there. What's that called for this young man? Secondary trauma. Much worse than the first one. Much worse. To the point that at that point he basically ran away from his family, from his community, and fell into the hands of a therapist who tried to and succeeded to help him to accept that he's homosexual. And I mean, people are looking incredulously. This is Emmett's. I'm sorry, Emmett. In Israel. This is true. True story. And it's not a crazy story. Elements of this story happen all the time. This man's life was destroyed by one person abusing him when he was young and being mishandled terribly. Now, he's not coming in to work on his sexuality. He's working to help deal with other psychological issues that are coming from trauma. So he's lost. I hope not forever. So you see the ravages of abuse and how critically important it is to deal with this problem. That's why the good folks at Magain and JCW need to be supported. They need to be not just supported, but they need partnership in terms of fighting this problem, because it isn't like it's a plague. It's a plague here, it's a plague in the United States, it's a plague in South America, we're getting cases in Europe. And this, I think, is the tip of the iceberg. But people are starting to realize they have to come forward. I'm here to let you know that there is hope. There's hope in terms of healing. Shibud Le'ula, from being enslaved by the ravages of youth to feeling that sense of liberation and empowerment from therapy, from healing, is a reality. You don't have to be saddled with the baggage and the paralysis anymore. I want to spend a few minutes talking about what treatment is about and how it works and how well it can work. So if you go back to the neurobiological explanation that I discussed earlier, if you take it to the next step, once it gets stuck in the right brain, the conscious brain transfers the material into the unconscious, and the unconscious tries to further process it through dreams. Dreams are representational or symbolic of baggage that has not been processed. And as soon as we start dreaming, we go through a dream stage in the sleep cycle, our eyes go back and forth rapidly. You know what that's called? REM. Stands for? Very good sleep class. Rapid eye movement. And interestingly enough, until 20 years ago, no one knew what its function. We saw it, we see little babies, we see the sleep labs, we didn't understand what it's about. But a world class, probably the world expert in the neuropsychiatry of trauma, neuropsychiatric research, a doctor named Dr. Bessel van der Kolk in Amsterdam, researched out, investigated what happens when you go back and forth. And he discovered that at least three things happen. There are more things that they're continuing to discover. The first